Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to our first discussion on multiple sclerosis. Started in August 2012, the Cure Panel Talk Show is broadcast live on Blog Talk Radio and brings together experts and patients for a discussion on important topics in healthcare and medical research. The show has hosted eminent physicians and researchers from leading medical centers such as Harvard Medical School, Mayo Clinic, MD Anderson, Washington University, University College of London Hospitals for discussions on topics ranging from multiple myeloma, prostate cancer, breast cancer to yoga and cancer nutrition. The show has been replayed and heard over 125,000 times. And we are excited to launch our talk series on multiple sclerosis. Multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune inflammatory demyelinating disease of the central nervous system. It is a leading cause of disability in young adults. For some, MS is a disease with one or two acute neurologic episodes and no further evidence of disease activity. In others, it is a chronic relapsing or progressive disease with an unpredictable clinical course that may span 10 to 20 years, during which time neurologic disability accumulates. There are four subtypes of multiple sclerosis, with three of the variants actually being progressive forms. Today, as we launch our top series on multiple sclerosis, we will be discussing treatments for progressive multiple sclerosis with our featured expert, Dr. Patricia Coyle. Dr. Coyle is Professor and Vice Chair of Neurology and Director of the Multiple Sclerosis Comprehensive Care Center at the Stony Brook University Medical Center, Stony Brook, New York. Dr. Coyle is the author of numerous articles on clinical and basic research aspects of multiple sclerosis and neurologic infections, and she is recognized as a leading expert on multiple sclerosis and neurologic infections. She is currently involved in a number of therapeutic trials testing new immunotherapies for MS. Dr. Coyle, it's an honor to have you here with us. Welcome to the show. My co-host for the show today is myeloma survivor and editor of myelomasurvival.com, Gary Peterson. Gary is now 8 years into complete remission post a stem cell transplant. He works with myeloma specialists to provide life expectancy and survival rate data to his site. Gary has been very gracious and is here to help us host our first show on multiple sclerosis. Welcome, Gary. On the panel, we have multiple sclerosis patients and advocates. I welcome Bradley Mann. Bradley was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis at the age of 35. Brad and his wife Robin have recently launched their website, sleepingwithms.com, and they also blog about life with MS, narcolepsy, and a busy family with four children on Everyday Health. We have Christy Salerno-Kent, author of Dreams, My Journey with Multiple Sclerosis. Christy Salerno was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1999 and since has recorded and produced her debut solo album, Believe. Produced and directed The Show Must Go On, a documentary designed to help others understand the physical symptoms associated with MS. Bonnie Cohen. Bonnie is a licensed physical therapist specializing in orthopedics. She works with a variety of patients with distal injuries of the spine, upper and lower extremities, and occasionally sees patients with varying neurologic issues at First Rehab in Fort Worth. Towards the end of the discussion, we will be answering questions submitted via mail or posted on our website. If you have a question for our panel, please press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you on air to ask your question. With that, I will hand over to Gary, who will begin with the show. Gary, you're on air.
Thank you. Can you hear me well enough, Priya?
Hey, yes, Gary, loud and clear.
Okay, very good. I'm on my cell phone, so I apologize for any interruptions in the service beforehand. I'd like to thank Priya and all the people from TrialX for providing this forum for the people with multiple sclerosis, just as she has with other forums for breast cancer, multiple myeloma, colon cancer, and a number of others. Because with this, we're able to bring to the patient community experts in the field that in many ways know everything, not everything, but so much about these particular diseases, and especially some that have been so very difficult to treat, as is multiple sclerosis. I became involved with multiple sclerosis many years ago when I was Texas, San Antonio, Texas, where I actually headed up the multiple sclerosis walk for a number of years. And so I got to know a number of people and understand how terrible this disease can be to those people. Welcome, doctor, and welcome, panelists, to the program. Dr. Cole, could you please tell me and describe the difference between the various types of multiple sclerosis, and this progressive multiple sclerosis seems to be the one that is far more difficult to treat. What percentage of the population of MS patients have this particular disease?
Well, 85 to 90% of MS patients start out with the relapsing form of the disease. So that is statistically the much more common form. Only 10% to 15% start out with progressive MS from onset. However, the natural history of untreated relapsing MS seems to be transitioned to progressive disease. And although I can't be absolutely sure about this statement, I think that lasting long enough, you would see the vast majority of relapsing patients untreated move into a progressive state of their disease. If we were defining progressive MS, we're talking about the insidious onset of clinical symptomatology with gradual clinical worsening, very slowly, looking at months at a time, that has to be completely independent of acute attacks, relapses, which is the more common form of MS. About 10 to 15% of MS patients will show gradual worsening from onset. It's very interesting. They tend to have a decade later age of onset from the more common relapsing form. Progressive MS from onset typically starts in the late 30s, early 40s, and it's the only form of MS that shows no female predominance. It's really a roughly equal gender ratio, males to females, about a 50-50 split. By definition, primary progressive MS is progressive from onset and can never have an attack or relapse, whereas there's an unusual form of progressive from onset referred to as progressive relapsing, which can have one or more superimposed attacks. Honestly, in my opinion, it's the same thing as primary progressive. If you're progressive from onset, then I think that marks a distinct phenotype. And then the final progressive form is called secondary progressive. Every secondary progressive patient started out as relapsing MS, but we know that there's risk for every relapsing patient to at some point, perhaps years into their MS, begin to gradually worsen. And at that point, once you've defined that, then they would be considered secondary progressive MS. So there's primary progressive and progressive relapsing, which is slow worsening from onset, and secondary progressive MS, which is something that occurs after the patient has started out as relapsing MS.
Okay, very, very, very good explanation. Thank you. What are the current treatments available for progressive MS?
Well, I'm sorry to say that we have no disease-modifying therapy that's proven to benefit the truly progressive slow worsening form of MS at this point in time. And that's recognized as a great lack. And there's a real focus at the current time in therapeutic trials in trying to document and find treatments that would help progressive MS. However, I would make the following points. We increasingly understand the importance of boosting brain and central nervous system reserve in everybody, even healthy individuals, but particularly for those that have a central nervous system disorder like MS. We now know that paying attention to wellness and health maintenance features is critically important, and I really consider this is a treatment for progressive MS. And what I'm talking about here is it's extremely important that things like vitamin D and vitamin B12 be looked at, and currently we think that we would like our MS patients to run a high normal vitamin D level. You want to be your ideal body weight. You don't want to smoke. You don't want to have a high salt intake. You want regular exercise, aerobic exercise, 3 times a week for 30 minutes. That actually improves brain function. It allows the brain to repair better. You need mental stimulation and socialization. These are key features. You want to make sure things like hypertension or being prone to diabetes or hyperlipidemia, these things, these medical things have impact on the brain and the spinal cord. They need to be treated and controlled and aggressively managed. And for people that have stress, it's impossible to take away from stress, but you want to make it as mild as possible, and you want to try to effectively treat it. I consider that whole health maintenance and wellness approach a treatment for progressive MS. And then finally, MS has a lot of symptoms. Progressive MS patients in particular have a lot of symptoms. And symptom management is a treatment for MS patients, very important because it has such a great impact on quality of life and activities of daily living.
Thank you, Doctor. The one thing maybe I got at myself with my first question and maybe what I should have asked originally was, could you please explain to the audience, and I'm sure that most people do know, but, you know, what is MS? And what I've been, long ago, when I was learning about it, somebody mentioned to me, it's kind of like it's like your nerves have an insulation, much like a wire over, the insulation on a copper wire, and that somehow this insulation, I think it was called myelin or something like that, this insulation somehow degenerates and becomes a short circuit, and that's really what's happening and what causes it.
That's a piece of it. That's a little bit of an old-fashioned concept of MS. The first thing that I would say is MS is a major acquired neurologic disease of young adults. Short of trauma, it's the major acquired neurological disease affecting the central nervous system, the brain and spinal cord in young adults. We don't know the cause. There are genetic factors that increase risk or protect against developing MS. There seem to be very important environmental factors that are at play early in childhood and adolescence that are critically important in segueing into MS. And then finally, the person's own immune system is attacking their own body organ, the central nervous system, the brain and spinal cord. And we know that there's inflammation, immune cells that penetrate into the brain and spinal cord, and they cause damage to the tissue. Think of the central nervous system as a master computer. So you spoke about the insulating myelin sheath, and that's true. MS is a demyelinating disease. The immune cells of the individual are stripping myelin, but the wires themselves underneath are hit. And that's much more important for progressive MS because we believe progressive MS is the neurodegenerative phase of MS, meaning it's hitting the wires, the axons, and hitting the nerve cells that sprout those wires. And you can imagine as you get lesions in various areas occurring in waves most of the time in untreated MS individuals, that depending on where they hit, you can get a variety of symptoms. So this is clearly a major neurological disease of young adults.
Thank you, Doctor. Can you speak about some of the clinical trials or therapeutic trials that are currently and specifically that are testing new immunotherapies for?
Absolutely. So let's talk about trials. First of all, the trials that are looking at trying to slow worsening, slow the progression. And there are a number of them because this has become a major focus because it's a big lack. The 10 disease-modifying therapies that we've approved in the United States are all for relapsing forms of MS. And then there are also, in earlier development, trials that are looking at repair, at fixing damage, at improving remyelinization or causing repair of fixed damage. And that's a whole different vista of treatment. So when we talk about, you know, current trials, it's very exciting. We have some phase 3 trials. Now, when I talk about phase 3, those are big, hundreds to maybe 1,000 or more individuals that are multi-center around the globe typically. Those are the trials that you can wind up going to the FDA if they're positive to trying to get approval for the drug. So in the case of primary progressive MS, there's a major phase 3 trial with the first approved oral agent called fingolimod for relapsing MS, and they're studying it in whether it's beneficial in primary progressive MS. There's also a very interesting major phase 3 trial with a monoclonal against B cells. It's an anti-CD20. It's called ocrelizumab. These two phase 3 trials in primary progressive MS should be reporting data sometime in 2015, I believe. In secondary progressive MS, we have a major phase 3 trial looking at natalizumab. That's a humanized monoclonal antibody that's given intravenously once a month. That's on the market already for relapsing forms of MS, and they're testing it in secondary progressive. There's also another phase 3 trial, major trial for secondary progressive, using an oral agent. The name is siponimod. That's actually a second-generation fingolimod, and that's in a major trial. In addition to these major trials, there are a number of other agents that are being tested, a number of oral pills, ibutilast, adebenone, epigallotecan galtate, masitinib. Fluoxetine is being tested in progressive MS, amiloride, oxcarbazepine. There's a T-cell vaccine that's in a fairly big trial in secondary progressive MS. It's a personalized T-cell vaccine. There's a stem cell study that's being evaluated, that's being tested in it includes progressive MS patients, and a monoclonal antibody that can help remyelinate that's going into testing. So a lot of studies are going on.
Do you think them look promising?
I think some of them look very promising. Now, obviously, when we talk about how quickly would they become available, number one, the study has to be positive. The phase 3 trials that I spoke about first, if you have one of those phase 3 trials positive, then I think that drug would go to the FDA pretty quickly, and hopefully it would wind up being approved. When we move down to the other agents that I spoke about, they're not in phase 3 trials. They're in earlier trials. So if the phase 2 preliminary trial is positive, then it goes on to a more major phase 3 trial. That's what you have to bring to governing agents to really get approval. That's the most definitive proof that it really works. So that would be a little bit more delayed. But, I mean, there's such an emphasis. And when you look at the amazing advances made in MS in the last, you know, 20 years, and now with the current focus on progressive MS and everybody realizing we need to get good treatments for progressive MS, I think it's only a matter of time before we establish therapies for progressive MS.
Well, fantastic, Doctor. Thank you very much. What I'll do now is I'll open it up to the panel member, and we'll take about 15 minutes and go through the questions from the panel members. Each panel member will ask a question, and then we'll go on to the next, and so on until we're done with the 15 or 20 minutes. Then what we'll do is we'll go to the questions from the audience, and hear from some of our members, and then go back to the panelists again. So first of all, Bradley Mann, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Gary. Nice to speak with you.
Very nice to speak with you, Bradley. Would you like to add anything to what Priya had to say about your journey?
Sure, absolutely. Actually, this phone call sort of is a full circle for me in that it was about 10 years ago when I was going through, you know, a time of uncertainty surrounding my initial diagnosis. And, you know, the terminology at the time that kept coming up was progressive MS, and I had absolutely no idea really what that – I've heard of MS, but what was progressive MS? And it was all kind of scary and whatnot. And I had done some research, and when I say it's come full circle in that at the time, the first book that I, you know, really sat down and read and sunk my teeth into was Dr. Coyle's book, Meeting the Challenges of Progressive MS. And I still have that book with all my notes in it. And it, you know, the knowledge I gained from that in helping to me make the correct decisions down the road, it was very beneficial. So I really want to thank Dr. Coyle for her efforts with that book and for my wife as well. It was very encouraging. And as far as, I guess, a question, you know, I find that all the current attention being paid now for progressive MS is actually a great welcome. And I'm just for Dr. Coyle, a question is that I'm a little confused, I guess, why, well, I guess my initial question is progressive MS a separate, could it possibly be a separate disease from relapsing MS in that, why has it taken so long to develop an illness, a disease-modifying therapy for progressive MS? Is it just because of the way it's operating, or could it actually be a separate illness in itself, and is that why it's taken so long?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I do not believe progressive MS is a separate illness. I view progressive MS as the neurodegenerative component of MS, the injury to axons and neurons. And this is a very important feature about progressive MS. It is age-related. It's kind of age-locked, where most typically you see progressive MS presenting is actually in the perimenopause for men and women. So it's kind of like midlife when you typically see it. Now, obviously, there are always exceptions, and you can have progressive MS in much younger individuals, but that's rare. What we now appreciate about MS is that there's injury to axons from the very get-go, from the very beginning, okay? There is neurodegeneration, injury to axons and neurons going on, even at the earliest MS time point. But there's no clinical expression of that because there's so much reserve in the central nervous system that it can withstand that injury. However, as that neurodegenerative component is ongoing, at some point, ultimately, you cross a magical line, and the central nervous system can no longer compensate, and now you begin to see the clinical appearance of gradual worsening, and I think that's the best way to think about it. It's very akin to how we understand Alzheimer's and Parkinson's now, where we know that there are the changes ongoing in the brain of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's for years before there's any clinical expression, because there's such good reserve in the brain that it can bounce back, it can recircuit things, it can accommodate that injury up until a certain point. So I really think that progressive MS is inherent in MS, and it's the neurodegenerative phase. Now, one might then think about the primary progressive MS patient, which never has relapses, as possibly missing or lacking the focal inflammatory phase that is so typical of relapsing MS. But I think right now, and we think of MS as heterogeneous, I definitely don't think it's a separate disease, but I think it's a separate principal neuropathology.
Okay, that's fascinating. If I can just ask a quick follow-up then, if the primary progressive patient would be missing the inflammatory phase or have a very small inflammatory phase, would that then possibly explain why MRI scans of a primary progressin patient could be quite different from a relapsing remitting patient?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Now, I'm going to make and I think this is an important point. There's inflammation in all forms of MS, including progressive MS, but it's different from relapsing MS. Relapsing MS has focal inflammation, and by and large, you tend to see more in the way of the obvious macroscopic lesions on MRI scan with relapsing versus progressive from onset, primary progressive MS. And primary progressive MS has much less in the way of enhancing, contrast-enhancing, gadolinium-enhancing lesions. That's much more common in relapsing MS, particularly in early years. However, if you use more sophisticated research neuroimaging techniques, primary progressive MS has a lot of microscopic injury. It has more microscopic injury than relapsing MS. It's just that the microscopic injury is invisible with regard to how we currently do clinical MRIs.
Excellent. Okay, thank you, Dr. Coyle.
Yes, thank you, Doctor. Christy Salerno-Kent, are you on board?
I am on board. And I wanted to start out by saying that I personally actually currently have relapsing remitting MS, and I think my hope is that by just sharing a little bit background on me, I think Dr. Coyle touched upon it, that lifestyle right now and what I do to take care of myself right now can potentially have a possible impact on the course of my disease, possibly. Is that correct, Dr. Coyle?
I think it's not even a possible. I think it's definitely helping CNS reserve. There's increasing data. So really following a wellness and health maintenance program, I've now come to consider that's a form of treatment.
Okay. So I was just going to just give a little brief background about myself. As a child, I a performer, and as early as 4 years old, I dreamed of being an actress, a singer, a dancer, a writer, director, mother, and Wonder Woman. And I just, it was actually when studying musical theater in college that I started to have issues with my balance and coordination. It kind of felt like certain parts of my body were wrapped in bungee cords, and I had very restrictive movement. But I did end up graduating, but a few years after that, while planning my wedding, which is generally pretty stressful, I started to have physical changes, tingling, pins and needles sensations in my feet and my fingers. My feet went numb, and my left leg felt really heavy, like I was dragging something along. And I kind of brushed off all those symptoms and ultimately woke up one morning unable to move the lower portion of my body. So a trip to the hospital and my first MRI, and I remember when the neurologist delivered the diagnosis of MS, it kind of felt like the curtain on my lifelong dreams was closing. And I actually went through, and I was determined to bear the burden of MS really on my own. So the next few years, I kind of did the only thing that felt natural to me. I pretended. I acted. I hid symptoms like fatigue and depression and spasms and pain. But the more I pretended, the less I felt like myself. So once I actually started to go back to the doctor and really talk openly and honestly about symptoms, I really felt like it was a turning point for me. And my ultimate dream above everything else was to be a mom, and I did actually accomplish that dream a few years ago when I gave birth to my son, and again, even more recently when I gave birth to my daughter. And there were a lot of things that worried me about having children, and one of them was being able to keep up with them and physically. And I remember there was a family trip to the zoo, and I had to keep stopping and sitting down, and every step that I took, I felt like I was walking through a bowl of oatmeal. And in the earlier years, I probably would have denied it or just accepted it, but I think I realized that the denial was just going to keep me from being the kind of mother that I wanted to be. So it was really a turning point for me to address, you know, a symptom like walking, which a lot of people take for granted, but it was really impacting my life. And so, taking action and fighting back really is what kind of keeps me moving forward and communicating with my family and my doctor. And this awesome MS community has really led to independence and a hope that I didn't think were possible, and certainly hearing some of the things on the horizon makes me feel that much more hopeful. So that's really the gist of why I wrote and published the book on my experiences. It was just another way to connect with people on a deep emotional level. And so hopefully that's a little bit of hope. Just like live theater, life is unpredictable. This disease is definitely unpredictable. But I think it's important for people to do exactly what we're doing here today and talk about it. And it's really freeing, I think, to share with others and learn more about the disease. And so that's about all I want to say.
Well, one thing for sure is that forums like this with doctors like Dr. Cole are so important, I think, for the education of, you know, the newly diagnosed as well as those who are going through the process. So I'm certain that there's a lot of people out there, Christy, that really appreciate that. Did you have a question for the doctor?
No, I think Bradley really kind of hit mine, actually, and really also what I asked about, you know, if taking action right now. I think in the beginning I was a very, I would sit back and wait for things to happen and then react. And I think Dr. Coyle has definitely helped me realize just in this brief call that it's really important to be proactive and really, talk and communicate, you know, with our doctors on certainly on certain symptoms and issues that are impacting our daily living.
Okay. Bonnie Cohen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Hello, Bonnie. Did you want to talk a little bit more about your journey and have a question for the doctor?
I do. First of all, Bradley Mann is my patient, and I appreciate him getting me involved in this discussion. I'm honored that he asked me to participate. So thanks, Brad. I had a question for the doctor first of all, Dr. Coyle. I was treating Bradley in the summer for a few months for symptoms of balance and coordination issues, and I could definitely speak more to that. But this most recent time, he came in with a knee problem, and I was doing my evaluation, and I found that his knee was stable to testing. He had seen other doctors, a neurologist, I believe, and then his general practitioner who did testing, and they didn't do x-rays or MRIs, but did physical testing and found that his knee was stable to testing. And he was sent to me, and I wanted to know, his symptoms are off and on, and initially he hurt himself, he twisted his knee falling over an object in his home that he didn't see was there. He has visual issues. And he vision issues, and so he did have like a mechanical injury, but his symptoms are very severe off and on, which isn't very typical of an orthopedic problem. And I wanted to know if it's the MS symptoms, maybe if it's the MS that can cause symptoms in a specific joint to be severe or not severe. Is that an exacerbation of the MS, and can it specifically be affecting a single joint on one side? I was wondering if she could speak to that.
Absolutely. What I'm going to say is general comments, because I can't get patient specific without having, you know, evaluated, spoken to,
right,
and seen the patient. It would be very unusual to have pain localized to a joint in MS. If I see something like that, I really am thinking about a joint issue. And so, for example, if you can manipulate the joint or you press in and it hurts, I'm not going to blame MS for that, okay? MS is a disease where the pathology is really confined to the brain and the spinal cord. Even the peripheral nerves are completely spared. The muscles are really completely spared. Now, obviously, the central nervous system is the master computer, and it supplies feeling, sensation, and motor control to the entire body. But it would be very atypical to have a localized joint pain and a joint tenderness. Much more common would be the entire extremity, burning pain, what we describe as nerve pain or central pain, et cetera. Obviously, MS is a moving target, and obviously when you have MS and you may have limitations in, you know, your ability to get around, there may be baseline problems with, you know, coordination or weakness, then you're going to be more vulnerable to have injuries. And obviously, just in medicine in general, we're very aware of things like falls, et cetera. So you can have injuries superimposed on baseline neurological deficits, and that's not a very good mix. So you really think very proactively about how to avoid things like falls. For each of my patients, when they have a fall, we go over was it preventable or not, and we try to learn a lesson, because if they came through without badly injuring themselves, then that's great, but we want to learn a lesson so we avoid a fall in the future. So I'm thinking that this sounds like it must be related to the mechanical injury, even though it seems episodic, and perhaps that's related to episodic, depending on how the joint is positioned or stress on it or strain. So I would say if it's continuing, then maybe it needs to be relooked at from that point of view.
Okay. His complaints were like a squeezing, and the pain was severe. Is a squeezing kind of... Is
again,
that more of a neurological? Okay.
It could be, but MS typically doesn't have a very small area involved. So
okay.
Typically you don't think of, like, my big toe hurts. That's highly,
right.
That's not very likely to be MS, just because
right.
Talking about getting a sensory tract, it's typically not just going to affect such a limited area. You'd like it to be a larger territory.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Bonnie.
Okay.
Yes, we now go around for our second round of questions, and that'll bring it back up to Bradley. Bradley, do you have another question? I know you do.
Sure, absolutely. I guess I'm following up slightly to what I touched on before with regarding MRI scans. Now, I guess my bigger question is a way of monitoring progress in patients with progressive MS. By the way, I keep saying the word patients with progressive MS. I hate using the term patients. I usually say someone living with MS, and I think it's just maybe I'm slightly nervous that I'm saying that. But so if someone's living with progressive MS versus relapsing forms of MS, I know that the reliability of an MRI is not always the same. And what I've been recently been seeing at Wills Eye Hospital and been using, and I know other places do as well, but basically I've been having OCT scans done. And it's opened up a whole new avenue for my other doctors to monitor my progress because I've had some dramatic changes on my OCT scan over the last 2 years. And I was wondering if you envision that in the future, OCT scans may be a new avenue just to monitor progress for all types of MS based on its not being invasive and its low cost.
Right. It's possible, but it's clearly not ready for prime time. This is a research
sure.
tool. So OCT, for the audience, is optical coherence tomography. And what it looks at is the back of the eye, the retina, where you have pure nerves and no myelin at all, and you can actually look at retinal nerve fiber layer thickness, okay? It's a machine. Typically, ophthalmologists have it. It's routinely used in cataracts and other, and glaucoma and other eye disorders. And you can, in 5 minutes, get a great readout that looks at the back of the retina and measures basically what would be axonal width. So there's been great interest in the MS neurology community about whether this might be an easy way to measure neurodegeneration in MS or to track neurodegeneration in MS. and it's one of the techniques that's being looked at. The problem is that it's clearly not ready for prime time yet. There are influences of, you know, direct eye injury. It hasn't truly, in my opinion, yet been mapped out to be representative of the more global brain volume loss or brain atrophy. But it may turn out to have a very valuable role. It's currently being tracked, and the larger the numbers of MS patients studied or MS individuals studied that you get, and longitudinal follow-up, then I think we'll have a much better idea, and we are seeing it increasingly used. I think what Bradley is referring to is the fact that in the progressive individual, it's very different from the relapsing individual. And so when you're looking at MRI techniques, contrast enhancement or T2 lesions per se may not be the most valuable. Things called T1 black holes are something that can be more helpful, or atrophy measures. That may be whole brain atrophy. That may be segmental gray matter atrophy or deep gray matter atrophy, maybe cortical, the more peripheral gray matter, and then techniques that look at microscopic injury, things like MAG transfer imaging, MR spectroscopy, diffusion tensor imaging, functional MRI scan. These are all very doable MRI techniques, but they're really just in research labs right now. They haven't come to typical clinical use, but there's a whole push to really establish progressive biomarkers, and OCT could be one. It could be one, but it's not ready for prime time yet.
How far away do you envision the ability to measure microscopic damage that you mentioned?
You want to know something? There's a major progressive trial ongoing right now. It's called SPRINT, where they're actually doing it across centers, academic centers in the United States. So it's going to be a very interesting experiment where they're using some of these cutting-edge techniques at different centers. It had to be standardized and being read at a central MRI site. So this phase two trial is in part almost like a proof of principle study. If this works and you can do these techniques and standardize them across centers to get, you know, uniform ability to read and put that data together, I think that will be a major breakthrough. And this is all potentially, you know, doable on regular clinical machines. But I think the first thing you want to show is that you can reproduce results across multiple different machines at different centers.
Would that be like the standard, I think it's the Whiteboard 3.0 that the centers are using today?
So we talk about like Tesla magnetic strength, and probably the most common MRI scans are at like a 1.5 Tesla, but more and more we're getting 3 Tesla, which is about double the magnet power. And definitely you can enhance the ability to detect small lesions, and you get, once it's standardized, because you can have, you do need to standardize it and get used to reading it. It's never exactly a piece of cake. You have to really work with it a little bit, but it gives much better pictures. You're right. So a 3T is definitely a better one, particularly if you're doing some of the techniques that are trying to look at microscopic injury, than on a 1.5. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that'd be really exciting because I know on a personal experience, my lesion load on my MRI is extremely unremarkable, as my doctor says, and it's completely not consistent with my OCT or
right.
my symptoms. So they've actually said once those techniques come out, it would be really exciting for myself. So I from personal
Absolutely.
Standpoint, I hope the future is soon.
Right. It's really not that far away. I really see some of these techniques may be used in a new MRI imaging battery for MS occurring within the next couple of years in routine clinical practice.
That'd be great. Thank
you. Yeah.
Sure. Christy, did you have a question?
Well, I find what Bradley just said so intriguing because he said his doctor said his MRI readings are kind of presenting unremarkable, and yet as somebody like myself who I consider myself, I mean, certainly MS has did in the past, had slowed me down quite a bit, but I feel like in the past at least 5 years, I feel like I'm very active, and yet my MRI presents as somebody who is has moderately severe multiple sclerosis, and that I have a extremely high lesion load. I have a number of black holes and that type of thing. So I just found that fascinating. So if Dr. Coyle has anything to say about that, I would be interested.
It's very interesting. So exactly, this is a dichotomy, and I think what it boils down to is that we don't evaluate microscopic injury in MS at all routinely clinically. So what you're seeing is what you're talking about is the macroscopic component. I want to say like the big lesions, the macroscopic component, but then there's a whole microscopic component, and I honestly think that's probably a major factor in the disconnect. And I'll also just mention that when we do repetitive MRI scans, most commonly it's brain, but the spinal cord is very important, and it's only in the last couple of years that we've gotten very good about analyzing spinal cord via MRI scan and being able to see lesions and areas of abnormality much better. So that's a whole nother major part of the central nervous system that's involved in MS that can give abnormalities. You can have injury there, and yet we don't, you know, use it as much as the brain MRI.
And then just to follow up on that, would you say that brain lesions versus spinal lesions, one has, is there a prediction in terms of the rate of progression or that type of thing?
So it's very interesting. Brain lesions and spinal cord lesions, believe it or not, are relatively independent in MS. Spinal cord lesions are one of the features. There's no absolute that's considered, let's say, a check mark for a worse prognosis or would raise concern in an individual. And there are at least some studies that have suggested that spinal cord lesions probably correlate, well, not lesions so much as maybe spinal cord atrophy correlate better with disability than brain atrophy. So there's a little bit of a, you know, a disconnect. What's going on at the imaging level for the brain may not be exactly the same in the spinal cord in MS.
Gotcha.
All right. Bonnie, do you have another question?
I do. Dr. Coyle, I know that with MS, the people, visual issues, vision is definitely an issue, and it gets progressively worse with the course of the disease. So I know from experience that vision affects balance. And when I do physical therapy, exercise with the patient, I work a lot on coordination balance if that's what they are coming in and presenting with. What are the long-term effects that you've seen? Have you seen, has doing the exercises for coordination balance actually pushed off the physical progression that is seen with MS, maybe happen later on in life for these patients? Because they have relapses, so are they back to square one when they have a relapse or exacerbation, or are they better off than they were from the effects of the exercises? I just don't understand, like, if they can either push it off to happen later in life.
Okay.
The physical issues. Go ahead.
So what I would say is as follows, and also keep in mind that as we get older, all of our brains are shrinking. So we're losing abilities from kind of the mid-teens, early adults on. Our brains are shrinking. That's a normal phenomenon. So there is an age-related phenomenon where the central nervous system is not going to work as well. So have that superimposed on the fact that if somebody has MS and they're untreated, there's kind of ad lib hits that are ongoing there. Now, what we are increasingly learning is as follows, and this is why I made such a major point about it, particularly for progressive MS, because rather than just say we don't have a disease-modifying therapy for progressive MS, the more important concept is we now recognize how important a wellness health maintenance program is to MS. So that can be implemented. I consider that a form of a disease-modifying therapy. We now know that exercise, particularly aerobic exercise on a regular basis, affects the brain. It affects the brain in everybody. You don't have to have a disease. It affects the brain in everybody. It affects the brain in a very positive way, okay? It really helps promote the ability to withstand insults, to repair, et cetera. So to me, then, it becomes extremely critically important that if you have central nervous system disease, then following a health wellness maintenance program is even more important for you, for that individual, than somebody who doesn't have to deal with the issues of having a neurological disease. So the physical therapy is really critically important and should be a lifelong issue and needs to be maintained. And I think that that can actually help the individual cope with the aging process as well as their, you know, disease process.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much.
Very good.
We've got about 10 minutes left, Priya, so if we could have our listeners who might have a question hit their keypad, hit 1 on their keypad, bring them online. So please, with your questions, we'd really like for you to be asking the questions. We do have some here, and so please do. Hit 1 on your keypad, and Priya will bring you online to ask your question of the doctor.
Thank you, Gary. Listeners can press 1 on your keypads, and we can bring you live on air. We have a caller. Calling from 6069655. Please ask your question. You're on air.
Hi, that's me. Basically, have a question. So I was diagnosed with MS almost a year ago. For years, I had symptoms, but they weren't really identified as MS. Like, I had my leg went numb, I had tingly fingertips, had episodes of vertigo, things like that. So all of it resolved. By the time I got diagnosed, it was because I had optic neuritis. I have over a dozen lesions on my brain. Now, I've responded well to Tecfidera, so I haven't had any new lesions, but I'm just concerned about, like, the initial lesion load. People tell me it doesn't really make a difference in terms of disease progression, but it sounds like it does because you have that, like, reserve where you can compensate. I mean, what does it mean if you're getting diagnosed later if you do have more lesions?
Right. Okay, so all of those are very good questions. I believe in principle the earlier a diagnosis is made, the better. And if there's the opportunity to go on a disease-modifying therapy that can minimize development of new lesions and disease activity, then that's really a good thing. So I think there is a press and urge to diagnose MS early. Okay, now that having been said, the era of the disease-modifying therapy started in the 1990s, and for those of us who took care of MS and diagnosed patients before that and afterwards, there isn't a single person who doesn't think we're making a phenomenal difference in changing the natural history of this disease and making it milder and more controlled. And I think, you know, MS has been a success story for neurotherapeutics, for neurology. So all the natural history studies that added up what's a good prognosis, what's a poor prognosis, were done in the era of no treatment. And if you have a disease-modifying therapy for a relapsing form of MS, then in my opinion, you want to get on it as quickly as possible. And also, keep in mind that the MRI scan that we typically do that looks at the kind of T2 or flare hyperintense lesion, that has no pathologic specificity. So you could have two lesions that appear as white marks on the brain MR. One could be a completely repaired, remyelinated lesion. The other could be a very destructive lesion. They look identical. You can't tell them apart on the typical hyperintense T2 flare, you know, study. So there's no pathological specificity. There are other ways, like the T1 black holes that we spoke of. That would be like a poor sign to have a lot of T1 black holes. But I think this is a very optimistic time. And I speak about the DMTs for relapsing MS. We need them for progressive MS. And that's why it's so realized and appreciated and why there's such a major focus. But we also realize and appreciate now, which we didn't so much a couple years ago, how key the wellness health maintenance is, and I do consider it a form of treatment. And I, in my heart, truly believe that if we get diagnosed progressive MS patients on such a program, it's benefiting them. It's benefiting the disease. It's keeping them in good shape as we develop repair strategies and strategies that decrease the neurodegenerative component.
Thank you, Doctor. We have another caller on line. Caller calling in from 414-5671. You're on air. Please ask your question. Person calling in from 414-5671. If you have a question for Dr. Coyle, please ask question. I think we should go to the questions that have been submitted. Dr. Coyle, we have quite a few questions submitted by our audience. We quickly go through them. The first one is there a relation between multiple sclerosis and lower vitamin B12 in the body?
Yes, there is actually. So number one, vitamin B12 deficiency is a bad thing. It can damage brain tissue and cause dementia, can damage the optic nerve and cause an optic neuropathy, can damage the spinal cord and cause a subacute combined degeneration disease with tract atrophy, and can cause a peripheral neuropathy. So you don't want to be vitamin B12 deficient. So it's standard in the differential diagnosis in working up somebody for MS to check vitamin B12. That having been said, we know that low normal B12 levels can reflect a relative deficiency in 5% up to 20% of individuals. So I won't tolerate a B12 level below 400 in my MS patients, even though it may be normal. And if they're below that, I boost them to have a level above 400.
Thank you. There's a next question on what are the contraindications to physical therapy treatment for someone with MS?
Zip, none.
Okay.
Encouraged.
I think
good.
There's a couple of... Okay.
Agreed.
Okay, there's a couple
agreed.
Of
it's all good.
Yeah, Bonnie. Okay. There are a couple of questions on nutrition. One says, would switching over to a vegetarian diet help MS patients?
Not necessarily. The dietary issues are number one, you want to make sure if you're vitamin D deficient, which significantly increases risk for development of MS. They now have recent data that suggests your level of vitamin D is associated with disease activity. So we like to aim for a level of about 70 of vitamin D25 hydroxy. You want to make sure your B12 level is over 400. You don't want to be eating a lot of saturated fats because that's really vascular disease promoting. If you have a healthy, balanced diet, maybe you boost unsaturated fatty acids and you watch out for those vitamin deficiencies, then, I mean, that is a good diet. There is not really documented data for doing esoteric, really difficult diets. At least none have been truly validated to benefit MS.
Thank you, Doctor. The next one says, what is the most effective treatment of spasticity in MS?
So spasticity is, like every symptom, is a multifactorial issue, and so I'm not going to be able to give one thing. If you're spastic, number one, you want to make sure you're not constipated, you don't have a cut or an active infection, because all of those things can make spasticity worse. Number two, you should be doing passive stretching, range of motion on a regular basis, at least for 10 to 20 minutes at a time. That's actually a treatment, stretching and passive range of motion, a rehabilitation technique. And then thirdly, you turn to medications. And the first-line medications would probably be considered baclofen and tizanidine, which both work on receptors in the central nervous system to decrease spasticity and they work on different receptors, and they have different side effects, and so it may be helpful to combine them at lower doses than you would go with anyone alone. And then I think second line would be gabapentin and benzodiazepine. And then sometimes you need to do more esoteric, such as a selected botulinum toxin injection, particularly if you have adductor spasm. In some significant spasticity cases, it may pay to have a pump inserted where you can give baclofen at much lower dose instilled right into the spinal fluid space to hit the lower spinal cord and affect it as positive.
Thank you, Doctor. I have a question for you, Dr. Coyle. Actually, I was just reading up about MS before the show, and I came across stem cell therapy for MS. Could you please just briefly just touch upon it and some of the clinical trials that are ongoing for this? And
I'm sorry. Could you please say that again?
Stem cell therapy.
Absolutely. So I touched on this a little bit before. We're trying to develop treatments that slow down progression and neurodegeneration, but that doesn't help fix deficits. It doesn't reverse what's already happened. Stem cells are part of a strategy potentially to reverse fixed deficit, along with others. They're not the only one. There are antibodies that seem to be repair or promote remyelinization. There are also neurotropic factors. There are other agents that can be used to manipulate repair. These are not as far along as the treatments that are aimed at slowing down worsening, but obviously they're very exciting. And keep in mind, it's not just MS that's driving the CNS repair, such as stem cell strategies. It's Alzheimer's, it's Parkinson's disease, it's ALS, it's traumatic brain injury, it's spinal cord injury. All of those need repair strategies to reverse fixed deficits. So stem cells is one component of that, one domain, and there are preliminary studies, but we still need to work out what are the best stem cells, what are the best dosing schedules, the best amount, what's the best way to deliver it. I think we'll see that happen in the next couple of years. I think we'll see more and more studies that are really helping to define, and I think in the next couple of years this could very well be a repair strategy able to be offered to patients.
Yeah, Priya, doctor, I have a question,
yeah,
if you don't mind.
Yes,
On the relapse-remitting MS, that's 85% of all patients.
Starts out, yeah.
Yeah, would you suggest that all, you know, is there a certain patients that should be treated and certain patients that shouldn't be treated?
Okay, all right.
Or should all patients be treated? And if so, does it slow the progression, meaning that they have a better quality of life for a longer period of time?
Very good question. Because the major progressive subtype is secondary progressive, and that is a relapsing patient. I can tell you my personal belief, okay? I think that every relapsing patient should go on an appropriate disease-modifying therapy as soon as the diagnosis is made. And I'm talking about ideally within 3 months of the diagnosis being made, and ideally within 3 months of the first attack. Now, can that prevent transition to secondary progressive disease? That's a critical feature. The disease-modifying therapies we have right now for relapsing forms of MS are anti-inflammatory, but inflammation does produce neurodegeneration. Particularly early on, there are inflammatory correlates of injury to axons, and we're beginning to get studies that indicate a significant delay in relapsing populations moving into secondary progressive when they're on treatment, when they're on a disease-modifying therapy. We just haven't had them long enough. Remember, the era was just ushered in 20, 21 years ago. You need like 30 years to really get an idea on truly changing this natural history. But all the evidence is pointing in the direction that the disease-modifying therapy seemed to be delaying and hopefully preventing a relapsing patient moving into a secondary progressive phase of the disease. So I'm a big proponent of early effective treatment. We have multiple choices now. There are whole different profiles. Getting on treatment as early as possible. There is benign relapsing MS, but unfortunately it's a retrospective determination looking back 30 years. And in my opinion, no one's really defined it. It makes up only 5% of MS. So if you're betting you're the 1 in 20, that's not a good, those aren't good odds. Those aren't good odds. Much better to get on a disease-modifying therapy, in my opinion.
Would there be any reason not to? Do some people have, side effects that are compromising?
But the point is you have so many options now that if you have side effects to one, it's highly unlikely that you're going to be sensitive to all of them. So there should be virtually no reason, in my opinion, not to get on a disease-modifying therapy.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doctor. I think you have been very helpful to a lot of people, and I'm glad that Priya and TrialX has put this program together, and I'm just glad I had an opportunity to have some small part in this initial program. Priya?
Thank you, Gary. Dr. Coyle, thank you very much for joining us today. It has been an honor and an absolute pleasure listening to you, and I'm sure our audience has benefited a lot. I thank the panel and Gary for their participation. You can always email me, priya@trialx.com, with your feedbacks and suggestions on MS topics that you would like to hear on the show. The link for today's broadcast will be sent via email to all the participants. Please join us again on Monday, where we have our monthly myeloma support group meeting, and we're talking with myeloma survivors Jim and Kathleen Bond about their myeloma journey. Please visit curepanel.carefeed.net for details of our upcoming shows. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.